I'm Pat Mitchell. It's a privilege to be your host for the afternoon and to remind us all of the most obvious fact, and that is that we are here because we loved and admired Jake. And of course, if all the people who loved and admired Jake were to try and gather, it would have taken a much larger space. Larger than any that probably exists in any country of the world that claimed Jake as their own. Jake was a man of the world with friends all over the world. But he was first and foremost a Canadian. No matter where he traveled or where he lived, where he and Fiona might have had houses, Montreal and Canada were their home. So it's only right that we'd be here in this city with friends from all over the world. The city that gave Jake so much of his spirit, his generosity, his genuine enthusiasm and curiosity about people and the world that inspired and was at the core of so much of his life and his work. He often said, "In Canada is where it took root, where it was nourished." Jake often talked about the critical role that this university, McGill University, played in his life. He embraced college life fully, as I'm sure those who knew him well know, and as I imagine we will hear throughout the afternoon, as he did everything in his life fully and completely. He graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering, just the right start, it seems, for a financier and filmmaker. He had a very special affection for McGill, and it was returned to him and is returned to him by his students past and present, and of course the faculty and alums who valued so much his loyalty and his advocacy. The current principal and vice chancellor of McGill University, Heather Monroe Blum, an accomplished scholar, joins us now to speak about Jake on behalf of McGill University. Chancellor.
Thank you very much. Bonjour, bienvenue, welcome, dear friends and colleagues. I just as I've walked through the hall talking to people, think about Fiona, as I'm sure you do, what it would have meant to Jake to see the people assembled here and to hear the friendship and conviviality and shared memories of those in the room. Let me start by saying how touched and honored we at McGill are to be hosting this memorial service here in this beautiful Redpath Hall at Jake's alma mater. And we thank you, Fiona, and the Eberts family for sharing this occasion with us and allowing us to join in the celebration of this exceptional man. Our hearts go out to you, Fiona, and to you, Lindsay, Alexander, and David, and to Jake's siblings and their children. The loss is deep. Jake was a big man. He was modest and soft-spoken, modest unless he was speaking about his family. But he was a large and enormously positive presence. Much praise has been heaped upon Jake for his high standards, his strong values, and his many significant professional achievements and artistic achievements. But from where I stand, as principal of his alma mater and having had the great joy of spending time with Jake and Fiona and getting to know him and Fiona, I must say it's how Jake lived his life and how he touched the lives of others that was truly profound. And how many people I've spoken to just again in walking around the hall who said, if we'd ever imagined life being short or Jake's life being short, we would have had him on our list along with Fiona, of the five or six people we would spend our time with, because everybody had in their minds, Fiona, the years and years that they would share with both of you together. That says an enormous amount about him at the end of our lives. We are really what is left and how people feel about us. As has been said, Jake had an enormous affection for McGill. He was proud of us. You see in so many of these photos, he's wearing McGill memorabilia on his sweaters, his hats, his his bags and so forth. And he also supported us selflessly. In his relationship with Miguel, he really joined his values with us, his cause with us. He was an extraordinarily active young student when he was a student here, and he was unbelievably sociable. He was the executive of the Winter Carnival. He wrote for the Miguel Daily. He served as president of the Alpha Delta Phi fraternity. He was the vice president of the Engineering Undergraduate Society. He was so busy with extracurricular activities that he joked that his parents were enormously relieved when he finally graduated. Some of you may be surprised to learn, it's been said, that he graduated with a degree in science and engineering. And indeed, he credited McGill Engineering with teaching him how to solve problems. Perhaps this was particularly useful in financing and film production, where I understand both have never-ending exercises in problem-solving. Jake had hoped to be at his 50th reunion of the chemical engineering class of 1962, held just a month ago. His classmates were as eager to see him as he was them. In his contemporary life with McGill University, he served on the Faculty of Arts Advisory Board. He wowed students everywhere he went, and they were attracted to him like a magnet. He lectured at the Dobson Center for Entrepreneurial Studies. He held premieres of his films in support of McGill causes. And where, perhaps most of all, Jake and Fiona and the Eberts family joined their values to the cause and values of McGill was in their creation of the Eberts Family Endowment to support Aboriginal students here at McGill, which they did in 2005. And which is having a lasting impact. For his great contributions to society and as a distinguished alumnus, McGill recognized Jake in 1998 with its highest honor, an honorary doctorate. For those who knew Jake casually, he leaves a legacy of respect and admiration. For those who were close to him, and there are so many who were close to him, Jake left this legacy of the deepest affection. And for millions around the world who never had the joy of meeting him, Jake Eberts left a legacy of some of the most moving images and stories ever captured on film. He will not be forgotten. His legacy cannot be erased.
And Chancellor, I want you to know that Jake never lost the opportunity to brag about the astonishing and remarkable woman who led McGill. He'd love to say that to anyone who would listen. I've been asked how I know Jake, and very briefly I met him when we both served on the Sundance Institute board for nearly 20 years. And my husband, Scott Sadell, and I became their neighbors, Fiona and Jake's, at Sundance. And shared so many remarkable, extraordinary times with him there. And when my husband met Fiona for the first time, he said to me that night before retiring, "Honey, if I ever leave you, it will only be for one woman in the world." And I've met her now. So he nicknamed her Fabulous Fiona. And she will always be Fabulous Fiona to anyone who knows her and loves her. And now she speaks of the man she knew and loved best, Fiona Eberts.
I don't know if it's because of what she just said, or it's menopause, or it's very hot in here, but I'm hot anyway. Thank you, Pat. First of all, a huge thank you to Principal Munro Bloom and to McGill University. You so generously lending us Redpath Hall and for providing so many of the additional services and assistance that went to making up this celebration. I'm so grateful for all of your help in this planning. Thank you. And thanks to you all for being here, coming through water and not hell, maybe, but certainly high water. We're incredibly touched, and it means a great deal to us, but we're not really surprised that you should come to honor such an extraordinary man. They say no man's a hero to his valet. Well, I wasn't his valet, but I did see, you know, the other side of him, so I do know what I'm talking about. So, first of all, bienvenue à tous nos amis francophones, canadiens et français, certains qui sont venus de très loin pour être parmi nous aujourd'hui. Bien que vous parlez tous un anglais impeccable, je tiens à vous remercier dans votre langue pour tout ce que vous nous avez apporté, les souvenirs des bons moments partagés, au golf, à la pêche, aux soirées joyeuses. Merci beaucoup. Je sais que Jake a tellement apprécié votre générosité, surtout votre amitié si chaleureuse et attentionnée, surtout pendant des moments très difficiles à la fin. Je remercie encore et encore. Car c'est un fond de la langue française que Jake a appris à aimer la nature. C'était avec son père qu'il a découvert les forêts, les rivières, les lacs de cette belle province de Québec. La pérennité, mais aussi la fragilité de cette nature qui a servi d'inspiration pour nombreux de ses films, comme « Au milieu coule une rivière », l'a profondément marqué et a nourri son âme. Il était soulagé que moi, fille de milieu urbain, aimais comme lui ces lieux magiques et que je partageais son admiration pour ce peuple, ses premiers habitants qui ont traversé les océans pour s'implanter dans des terres hostiles où l'hiver est rude et longue, et qui, devant toutes les difficultés, ont su garder leur tradition, leur culture, leur foi, et surtout leur langue. Well, many people have remarked that Jake seemed to have lived three lives at the same time, and I'm really grateful that he didn't do it with three wives, either concurrently or simultaneously. Although there were times I could have used some help, actually, keeping up with him, that's for sure. We first met in Brussels in 1966. He was tall, engaging, witty, slightly geeky, it must be said, with horn-rimmed glasses and a truly world-class stutter, which has already been mentioned today. But he had a self-confidence to match. People would squirm and look at their feet while the minutes ticked by waiting for him to say or mum. But he was completely unfazed. I was so impressed. This was someone who couldn't give a damn what anyone thinks. This was a quality manifest throughout his entire life, I may say. Well, he was Canadian. I learned that Canadians are not Americans who say out and about, that they have more than 1 week of summer, that the best way to eat eggs and bacon is with toast and marmalade, lots of it. That was the Canadian way, apparently. That Canada's a huge country with relatively few people, and they're all related. So a new addition to the gene pool was probably quite helpful there. Though still very young, Jake had an interesting career trajectory. He had this degree in chemical engineering. Why? Well, because all his friends were doing liberal arts. He didn't want to be like all the others. Well, he wasn't that was for sure. Then there were summer jobs as a roustabout in the Western oil fields. This is him on top of a pole. He was timber cruising as a sewage analyst in Stockholm. He probably didn't tell you a lot about that one. Well, this was a job, he said, prepared him for some of the truly awful scripts he had to read later on. He was co-manager of a liquid oxygen plant in Spain, which almost blew up and nearly wiped the town of Cartagena off the map. He apparently saved that. Then to Harvard for an MBA, at which point he imagined the world would be his oyster. But oh no, not a single offer from Wall Street. Somewhat desperate, he got a job in Columbus, Indiana, selling diesel engines. Well, an unbearably hot and humid summer, combined with dinner every night with the boss and his two very enthusiastic and unmarried daughters, had him begging for a transfer to Europe. Now, this is when destiny started to arrange things. And this is where we first met. And Charles Hart is here today. He introduced us. I reminded him of this today. Thank you, Charlie. You started the whole thing. You see that? Truth be told, I fell in like with Jake, which is a good foundation for love. We shared the same sense of humor. We laughed well and long about everything, right to the end. He often told me the acid test for him was that I got his jokes. And they were deadpan and not very obvious at times, but somehow I understood his sense of humor. Well, after 3 months, 3 short months, he asked me to marry him. At least that's what I thought I heard. Because he was stuttering so much that I wasn't sure. But whatever he was trying to say, I just said, yes, okay. So he gave me a paddle. I got into the canoe. Off we went on our life journey. He was 26. I was an embryo. It was February 1968. First stop on our honeymoon was Jerusalem, and I mention this because Jerusalem is the subject of the last film Jake was involved in, which is going to be released in 2013. And so that's some wonderful bookend here. Anyway, a month later, we started married life in New York, where he finally got that job on Wall Street in an investment bank. Our apartment was on the West Side, otherwise known as the Wild West Side. This was 1968, and one where a mixed marriage was between a man and a woman. Someone said that to have a family, you have to move to the suburbs, Scarsdale, Larchmont, Greenwich, you know. Jake would commute, but not for us. We decided to make London our suburb, and Jake landed a job with Oppenheimer & Company, an investment bank, just opening an office there. And it was in London that we were joined by our 3 children, Alexander, David, and Lindsay. Now, while all was happy on the home front, things weren't going too well on the career front. Nothing was working. Jake was casting around all over the investment banking scene, but no bites ever, until finally something struck. Not fish, but rabbits. Someone asked him if he could find the money to make an animated film of a best-selling novel, Watership Down, by Richard Adams. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, that is the straw he grabbed when all else was going pear-shaped. Lady Luck had finally shown up, and rabbits saved our bacon, so to speak, mixing barnyard metaphors. He put together the financing, they made the film, it found distribution, actually made it to the theaters. He was elated, he'd found his niche. I, on the other hand, saw a greased slide to a homeless shelter. Movies, oh no, what fresh hell was this? Well, that might have been the case with anyone else but Jake. Looking back, I think the universe made sure that nothing else worked to get him ready for the moment he would find his true calling. And it was perfect for someone with major attention deficit disorder who could listen to 3 conversations and keep 10 balls in the air at once. He would enable stories to do what they did best, tell great stories. He had the taste, the intuition, the business background to deal with the money side, the charisma to convince, the presence, the integrity to pull it all together. Well, he soon left Oppenheimer to found Goldcrest Films, and there followed a steady stream of those wonderful movies for theater and television, which, according to Roger Wilkes, whose obituary appeared in the Daily Telegraph, he was responsible for the revival of the then moribund British film industry. Films like Another Country, Local Hero, Killing Fields, The Dresser, and many, many more. And all of this he wrote about in his book, My Indecision is Final. So when he started out, this Canadian outsider from a banking background living in London might have looked like so much bait as he waded into the shark pond known as Hollywood. Well, the usual scenario goes thus. You move to Hollywood, you move to LA, you turn in your first wife or one or more starlets, you buy yourself a Rolex and a Porsche, you get your own table at the Polo Lounge, and then voila, you're a producer. Well, Jake never luckily for me, bought into that. He kept the same wife. We stayed in Europe. His watch was a Timex. He would show up for meetings with studio heads in a rented Toyota Camry. He couldn't care less. Over the years, as he forged on, producing one Oscar-nominated film after another, he miraculously managed to do this, keeping all his fingers and toes and his integrity intact. It was truly breathtaking, and people still wonder how he did it. No showgirls, well, that's a euphemism I have to use. I'm not allowed to say the real word. Cocaine or shady deals. It helped that he was very, very smart, inventing new ways to finance films and, bizarrely, make them profitable. He was a tough negotiator, but fair, willing to compromise, always left something on the table. His eye was firmly on the prize. The gut feel which he used to choose his subjects came from who he was, an idea that if he loved a story, well, why wouldn't someone else? I'm Joe Average, he'd say, not. Never try to guess, second-guess the public was his maxim. Well, the stories he made inspired many. Big ideas wrapped in good storytelling, which never felt like medicine. Before he died, he said the kind of films which interested him were no longer what the public wanted and that his era was over. Well, this was just a recognition of today's reality, which is why he was more and more interested in documentaries and films such as Journey to Mecca and Jerusalem. And now a word about Jake as a Canadian. Well, he deeply loved this country, which has already been mentioned today. He wore his Order of Canada with pride. He was proud of Canada's reputation for tolerance, diversity, and global reputation for fairness and moderation. There were many, many doors that were open to him more readily, precisely because he was Canadian, in the Middle East in particular. And in return, his integrity, his genuine respect, and connection to other people and cultures made him an excellent ambassador who did his country great honor. Well, we had 44 years of conjugal happiness, which was a whirlwind ride with never a dull moment. Actually, I could have used a few dull moments, but it was not to be. Yes, there were times when I wanted to whack him with my paddle, and he pushed me overboard, I'm sure. But our recipe for success was that I gave him room to do the things he loved, because I didn't really have a choice. And he never tried to tell me what to do, because he was too smart for that. Now, for my 60th birthday, he asked me how I'd like to mark the event, have a party, go on a cruise. I said, I'd like to attend an alternative medicine conference in Hungary and then bring the whole family to celebrate over there. He never blinked. And, long story short, that is how we came to spend my birthday in a transvestite bar in Budapest. Watching Desiree Dubonnet, formerly known as Bill, dance around a pole while singing a Debbie Harry hit. Bemused, marginally uncomfortable, yes, but complain, never. Well, he was my only husband, and I was his only wife, and as far as I know, my only real competition came around 2004. She was slim, dark, new, and exciting. He said she was helpful, available night and day, life-changing. He was completely under her spell. His friends loved her. They knew she was with him wherever he was in the world. And through her, they could reach him at any time. Well, I found her pushy, demanding, and intrusive. I could have happily thrown her into the nearest canal. Her initials were BB, and it's not Brigitte Bardot. Yep, towards the end of his life, he didn't admit he wished he hadn't spent so much time with her. And no, she is not in his will. Well, I've received hundreds of letters and emails about Jake. They've been a source of huge support and comfort and strength through our loss, and we're deeply grateful to everyone for writing me. Two themes have come to the fore. One is, in a nutshell, well, I'm a better person for having known Jake. And I've thought long and hard about this. Well, I know what he was like as a father and a husband, but what was it about him which leads people to feel that? Perhaps it's simply because in a world where we are literally drowning in lies and spin, a world of PR and hype, someone like him, recognizably transparent and authentic, stands out like a beacon. Someone who can succeed but not cheat and lie and steal to make it, to be in private exactly what he appears to be to the outside world. Well, these are rare people. People we recognize and need, and human history is only a series of examples of what went before, show and do. And each example is a torch lighting the next bit of road. Well, that's who Jake was. He was the real deal, and you can't fake it or act it. It just shone out of every pore. And the word Mahatma means great soul, and though he'd cringe to hear me call that, to my mind and many others, he was indeed a great soul. And then the other thing I hear is, he went too soon. Yes, we could have all used a bit more of Jake. In the words of our friend Terry Gilliam, he was like a snow-capped mountain. Huge, unflappable, permanent. We can't believe he could die. He just didn't seem the type. Well, we all know that he was also like a rocket, permanently in motion. There was never a trip or a vacation, no matter how short, that he didn't want to make shorter. Well, how about leaving tomorrow instead of Sunday? There's an earlier flight. Why? Because he was relentlessly driven forward towards another horizon, another dawn. And honestly, it didn't really surprise me that he left earlier than we might have wished or expected. His curiosity and forward motion has taken him to worlds we don't know yet. But to be sure of one thing, wherever he is, he'll be savoring his surroundings with his eternal curiosity and optimism. There's a Zulu saying, not yo, what's up, hey dude. The person says, Sawubona, which means I see you. And the response is, Ngikona, I am here. Now, many have said to me that one of the special things about Jake was he seemed to see all of us in a deeply personal and connected way, even when he was with that other woman I just mentioned. It's said that a dog looks at everything and sees nothing, but a cat looks at nothing and sees everything, which is maybe why Jake so loved cats. So, dearest Jake, from all who love you, we saw you, we still see you, and I know what he's saying. I am here.
Fabulous is just not enough when it comes to describing Fiona. Thank you, Fiona, for sharing so much of Jake, and thank you for being all that you are in the world. So we've heard a bit about Jake the filmmaker. We're going to hear more from two extraordinary men from the film industry, beginning with Canada's own Denis Arcand, Quebec's most renowned and accomplished director, having directed three of the five Canadian movies to receive Academy Award nominations. He's been awarded Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Film Awards in so many different categories. He's revered by other Canadian filmmakers and global audiences. Please welcome Denis Arcand.
Jake used to say that he never saw a movie that was too short. For myself, I never heard a speech that was too short. So I will then be brief. Jake was the most improbable film producer, one with high moral values. He thought that films should promote decency, nonviolence, respect for native people, for the environment, for religious faith. Normally, this attitude should have sentenced him to an early bankruptcy. But miracles do sometimes happen, and he ended up being extremely successful. He was so high-principled that at some point he refused to invest in one of my movies, Love and Human Remains, because he thought that the character's behavior was immoral. He was right on two counts. They indeed behaved immorally, and it was also one of my least successful movies. Despite these differences, we got along famously. I drive a Toyota Camry, and my watch is a Casio. I was playing tennis this morning and thinking of his love of the game. I already miss him. We all do. Thank you.
Always thoughtful. Fiona's suggesting that we take a 5 or 10 minute break so that you might circulate, have another drink, a little bit to eat. We have several interesting and important speakers to come, and we'll begin the next session in about 5 minutes with a montage of Jake's films. Friends of Jake. Thank you. It's my pleasure now to introduce to each and every one of you another Canadian son, Jeff Skoll, educated in Canada as an engineer, becomes an internet entrepreneur, and now filmmaker and philanthropist. Jeff Skoll, through his company, Participant Media, has produced films that have received dozens of awards, 26 Academy Award nominations to be exact, not to mention Academy Awards for Best Picture. But even more to Jeff's purpose, these films have launched social change campaigns that have had impact on issues like education, hunger, immigration policy, climate change, and so many others. Jeff calls Jake his mentor, but I know that Jake said about Jeff, he is making the kind of films that will change the world. Please welcome Jeff Skoll.
Thank you, Pat. I love Jake. He was to me everything that could be found in a friend, guide, mentor, and fellow traveler. I first met Jake in 2003. I was planning to start an entertainment company that was focused on making movies that matter, that would make a difference in the big issues in the world. And so I spent some time going around LA talking to people in the business and trying to see if anybody had ever done this before, and if so, how. Around that time, I went to my first Hollywood event. It was a big star-studded affair with stars everywhere, big-name people, and I had never seen such a thing. But a friend of mine led me over to a tall, dignified gentleman who was enthusiastically typing away on his BlackBerry and said, "For what you are doing, this is the most important person you'll ever meet." And it was true. I had just met Jake, the one person who really saw the film industry as a vehicle for social change. Between movies like Gandhi and Chariots of Fire, Driving Miss Daisy and A River Runs Through It, and dozens of other films, Jake created unforgettable art that touched the lives of millions of people. He financed or produced over 50 films, with 66 Academy Award nominations and 4 wins for Best Picture. From his time at Goldcrest Films through Abu Dhabi, Pathé, National Geographic, and others, Jake was the gentle giant of the film industry, loved by all. Kevin Costner, who Jake worked with on Dances with Wolves and Open Range, once said, "In Hollywood, there are two types of people, people with intelligence or people with integrity. Jake is the only one with both. Jake helped me to navigate the industry, and he was a mentor to me in so many ways, and not just to me, but also to Jim Burke, who I had hired to be the CEO of Participant. Jim and I had the pleasure of collaborating with Jake on the film Oceans, which was an epic production, 7 years in the making. And in classic Jake style, it went on to be one of the top grossing documentaries of all time and is still a catalyst for change in preservation of the oceans. In 2005, Jake and I traveled to Israel and Palestine, where we had the movie Gandhi dubbed into Arabic for the first time. And that was important because the film had never been dubbed, and most Palestinians knew nothing about the Gandhian principle of nonviolent resistance, and we thought that that was a better path to peace. So with Jake and Ben Kingsley, we had a premiere at the big cultural center in Ramallah with 1,000 Palestinians, and Jake made a speech saying, I'm a Muslim and a Hindu and a Christian and a Jew. Moreover, so are all of you. And after Jake's speech, there was not a dry eye in the house. That program went on to reach 100,000 Palestinians who saw the film and participated in discussion groups afterwards, and we think has helped to some of the stability in the region. Today, I'm proud to be one of the people carrying Jake's torch. In fact, all of us here tonight are carrying a bit of Jake's torch with us in our hearts. Jake may have been taken from us too early, but he left behind him a legacy that will not be forgotten. Thank you.
God made me for a purpose, but he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure.
The hell is going on?
I don't know, sir. The agent got a telegram, and it just said he is coming.
My name is Gandhi, Mohandas K. Gandhi.
Well, whoever you are, we don't want you here. I suggest you get back on that train before it leaves.
They seem to want me.
I don't want any trouble.
I'm an Indian traveling in my own country. I see no reason for trouble.
After what they did at the massacre, it's only an eye for an eye.
An eye for an eye only ends up making the whole world blind.
Gandhiji, do you know the sacrifices people have made?
If we obtain our freedom by murder and bloodshed, I want no part of it.
I am a Muslim, and a Hindu, and a Christian, and a Jew, and so are all of you.
Mahatma Gandhi has become the spokesman for the conscience of all mankind. He was a man who made humility and simple truth more powerful than empires.
Cambodia, to many Westerners, it seemed a paradise. But the war in neighboring Vietnam burst its borders, and the fighting soon spread to neutral Cambodia. In 1973, I went to cover this sideshow struggle as foreign correspondent of the New York Times. It was there in the war-torn countryside amidst the fighting between government troops and the Khmer Rouge guerrillas that I met my guide and interpreter, Dith Pran, a man who was to change my life in a country that I grew to love and pity.
When I heard you were coming to our abbey, I thought it was an answer to my prayers.
Leave this place at once. The devil is roaming this abbey.
You may burn Brother Remigio, but you will not put a stop to the crimes being committed in this abbey. Other monks will meet their deaths here. and they also will have blackened fingers and blackened tongue.
Mother's a little high-strung. The fact is, you'd be working for me. She can say anything she likes, but she can't fire you.
What are you doing?
I'm trying to drive you to the stove.
Where are you off to this morning, Miss Worthen?
Oh, just a little shopping. Go away. You're my best friend.
Oh, go on now, Miss Daisy.
No, you really? You are. You are.
Just hear that you've been decorated, and they sent you here to be posted.
Actually, sir, I'm here at my own request.
Why?
I've always wanted to see the frontier.
You want to see the frontier?
Yes, sir. Before it's gone.
Nearly all those I loved and did not understand in my youth are dead. But I still reach out to them. Of course, now I am too old to be much of a fisherman. And now I usually fish the big waters alone. But when I am alone in the half-light of the canyon, all existence seems to fade to a being with my soul and memories. And the sounds of the Big Blackfoot River and a four-count rhythm and the hope that a fish will rise. Eventually, all things merge into one, and a river runs through it.
That's you, that ball, that flag, and all you are.
I'm not going to my maker without knowing your given name. Mine ain't Wade. It's Postlewaite. Charles Travis Postlewaite. What's yours? Sure ain't boss. I mean it, boss. I'm asking you straight up.
It's Blue Bonnet.
Blue Bonnet?
Blue Bonnet, yeah.
No middle name?
Just Blue Bonnet Spearman, and don't you tell no one. I want to hear you swear an oath. Now go on.
I swear.
I am ready now to leave the safe shores of my home, to see with my eyes what I have seen in my dreams. Mecca is 3,000 miles to the east. Some say it is too far, but I am determined to make this journey. As so many have in the past, and so many will in ages to come.
Allahu Akbar. Allah, Allah.
What an incredible, incredible legacy that Jake left in movies, the kind of movies that will last forever because they're built on the values that are the most important. And Jake exported those values to many different places. He had a relationship with Abu Dhabi and the United Arab Emirates, where he also used movies and films to bridge cultures. He had a strong working relationship and close friendship with Khaltun al-Mubarak, who is a businessman and chairman of the Executive Affairs Authority in Abu Dhabi. He couldn't be with us, but he sent us this taped message.
Jake was one of those unique individuals that came here and became really part of the society, part of this culture, someone that everyone had a special place for Jake to. And, you know, we all mourn Jake today. We all miss Jake. But at the same time, we all look back at all the good things that Jake has brought to us and all the good things that will always stay with us because of what Jake has done and because of Jake being Jake. We had about a month ago, a film festival. And this film festival wouldn't be what it is today without Jake's guidance, Jake's leadership, the Jake touch. You look at National Geographic Abu Dhabi, couldn't have happened without Jake. You look at many of the partnerships that have been established with companies like Participant and others, couldn't have happened without Jake. So many of these ventures, I think, will long be with us. And all of them, and I can say quite genuinely, Jake has had a very integral part in putting together. Jake was one of us. Jake will always be one of us. And, you know, he might not be wearing this this ghutra, but he embodies it probably just as much as I do. One of the key editing studios at the Abu Dhabi Media Zone, 2454, has been named after Jake. It's the Jake Ebert Studio. I think this is just a simple gesture for a man that deserved a lot more. Hopefully, and I have no doubt with what he's left, you know, Fiona, Alex, Lindsay, and David, that relationship will always continue. And that link with us here in Abu Dhabi, with his other family here in Abu Dhabi, will always continue.
But Jake was a man of the world, loved and admired in so many cultures, as we said, and he fit in just everywhere because he had such respect for the way others lived. But his longest and truest friendships, have to be said, were most often with his fellow Canadians. Paul Desmarais is such a friend, a global businessman himself. Paul was made an officer of Canada in 2004. He's the co-chief executive officer of the Power Corporation of Canada. Please welcome Paul.
I think as a businessman, I'm probably all going to surprise you because Fiona asked me actually to share with all of you a spiritual journey that I was fortunate to share with Jake over this last year. Actually, it started in March of last year at Mont Tremblant. And after a great day of skiing and a long lunch, we were showing Jake the village, and I suggested that they go and have an afternoon tea at the local inn while I step away for a half hour or so and go to church at the small chapel in the village. They both looked at me with stupor and said, well, why don't we come along? I said, well, look, you're welcome to come, but look, you don't have to. And he said, no, we'd like to come. And so they came along, and the mass got started, and Jake became, during the service, very emotional, shed a tear or two, and afterwards shared with us that the service had reminded him of his childhood. And he reminded how his French-Canadian nannies at the time would bring him to Mass every Sunday. And suddenly his whole childhood came before him, and it also suddenly reunited him and reconnected with a spirituality that was obviously deep within him. And so I think that was sort of his first sort of moving moment as it happened, and sort of lucked into it in a way. Then in July, incredible thing happened. I was having dinner with a Father Rusica here in Montreal. And Father Rusica is the founder of Salt and Light, sort of Christian television in Canada. And so we're going on about all kinds of things. I'd just been in a visit to Jerusalem. And suddenly we get on to, during our conversation, that he had just completed a documentary on Saint André. Frère André, actually, more precisely. And Frère André was actually the first Canadian to be canonized for his many healings that he did and miracles that he did here in Montreal, actually, and for the founding of St. Joseph Oratory, which is a gigantic building on the mountain. You can see a cathedral church. And I, of course, said, my God, I said, this Frère André did all these miracles. I said, well, do you think it might be worthwhile to actually go there? And, you know, I have a friend that's actually struggling with cancer. And do you think it might be of any help? And he sort of looked at me and went, duh, like, does this guy get it or what? I said, yeah. He says, yeah, of course it'll help. And I said, well, do you mind? I'm going to call him right now. So I get Jake on his the girlfriend there, the BlackBerry. And Jake, fortunately, was coming fishing with me the next morning. So I knew I had him in the morning. So I said, Jake, instead of 9 o'clock, how does 7 o'clock feel? I'm going to come and pick you up with this Father Rusica, who actually you'd met. And he's got a great idea. He's going to take us to the oratory all together, and we'll go and pray before we go fishing. So Jake says, sure, I'm game for that. Next morning, we get out there in the car. We all go to the oratory. And lo and behold, Father Rusica takes us first, instead of going to the oratory, to a little house just on the edge of the oratory where actually Frère André had lived. And you can picture this little room. It's about 12 by 12. There's a bed, a little desk, a little wash basin, and these three grown men sitting in front of the bed, standing in front of the bed. And Father Rusica says to us, do you mind if I lead you in prayer? And I said, no, of course, Father, let's pray. And so I can tell you, we started praying, and it was became extremely emotional. I must say, of course, being where I was praying my heart out for a miracle. I said, boy, if you've ever prayed, this is your time. So we, after a while, left Jake alone because he was clearly having a connection with God. He was very moved and very taken. We then went on, of course, to visit the tomb of Frère André, spend an hour and a half in the basilica, touring all the different places, lighting every candle I could light, as you can imagine. And then we got off into the car, said, let's go to the fishing trip. And then an incredible thing happened. Jake told me an incredible story. He said, Paul, I have to tell you that I have a housekeeper that's been with us for years, and she's actually a direct descendant of Frère André. And if you can believe this, there's a plumber in the town that took care of our house, and he had terminal cancer. And she suggested to him and his wife that they should come to the oratory and that a miracle might happen. And Paul, a miracle did happen. The doctors never got over it. He's healed, and he's okay. I said, well, Jake, great. And we were right. I prayed, we prayed, and we did the right thing. And, you know, a miracle might happen. But he says, Paul, there's more than that. He told me that when he was there, he broke into a sweat, and he felt this heat wave while he was there. And, Paul, when we were together and praying, I felt that same heat wave. Look at my shirt. I've perspired right through my shirt. And he said, Paul, I could feel a connection like I never could have imagined. I said, Jake, you know, maybe it's a miracle. I mean, let's hope it is. But in the meantime, let's go fishing. So we're back out on the fishing trip, and we had a wonderful time. If you can believe this, a bunch of fishing buddies watching at night a film documentary on Saint-André, you know, you can imagine, it's a bit odd, but we did it. We watched it, enjoyed it, loved it, and I think it meant a lot to Jake. Now, Jake said to something even more incredible to me. He said, you know, Paul, while we were on the fishing trip, he said, what I didn't tell you is that I visited the oratory a few times. I said, really? I said, yeah, I've been there a few times. And nothing happened. So he says, you can imagine when this prayer came and I felt what I felt, I'm extremely thankful for. Well, time rolls on, and I visited Jake the afternoon before the morning of his passing away. Of course, I came in and I said, Jake, I said, you know, the good news about you is there's one thing I'm sure is you're going to heaven. And there's not a lot of people you can be sure about that. But you know what? I'm so certain you're going to heaven that I want you to know something. You know what I'm like? I want you to save a seat for me. And Jake, you know, had come out of a bit of a coma, and I was touching him, and he looked at me and he said, he smiled. Now, Jake, you know what I'm like? I want a front row seat. And Jake looked at me and he said, yeah, yeah. He's smiling again. And I said, remember, you know, they tell me something else, Jake. They say golf is great in heaven. And so Jake looks at me. I said, I know it's hard for us to believe, but I'm told it's even better than Men for Magog. And so Jake looked at me, and he said, Paul, he says, don't worry about it. You know, as soon as I get there, I'm going to be working on all this. You can count on me. And this is a man who was under a lot of strain, and he's saying these wonderful things, and then he said something that really struck us. He said that he was ready to turn to the other side. And I remember Fiona and I were there, and of course, we're two nincompoops in a way. We're thinking, well, he wants to turn in his bed, so we're thinking, oh, well, we'll help you. And he just looked at us and he smiled. And you know, it's a funny thing, but I realized a few days after, when Fiona called me and said he'd passed away, I suddenly realized a miracle's happened after all. God had done his work. Jake was at peace and ready to leave us, and he knew it. Now, later that afternoon, after the visit, I remember the nurse came, they changed him hospital room, which I thought was quite an incredible thing for his final moments, so that he could be alone in a single room. And can you believe it? Fiona said, I walked in that room and I could just see out the window a dome of the oratory. I mean, can you believe the chance of that? Now, I'm thinking to myself in retrospect, Jake certainly taught us how to live life to the fullest. There's no doubt about it. But I think more important, he also taught us how to pass on, how to move along, and how to move to another world with grace, in peace, and in harmony with God, his family, and his friends. Fiona, in describing Jake's last moments, said to me, Paul, we all stood there, the three kids and myself, holding hands, all together. Said Jake looked up, he smiled, and he passed away. Thank you, Jake. Thank you all.
Thank you, Paul. Jake's most lasting legacy and his source of greatest pride were our three last speakers for the afternoon, his three remarkable, extraordinary children. Please welcome Alexander, David, and Lindsay Elberts.
Well, what an honor it is to be here with all of you today. It is just magnificent to look over and see so many friendly and supporting faces. I know that you've been standing for many, many hours listening to some speakers who are extremely, extremely difficult to follow. Most importantly, my dear mother, who could not have said it better. So we're all going to try and be brief. And as many of you know, Dad wasn't really very social in the classic sense of the word. In the unlikely event that you could actually get him to a reception or a cocktail like this, as soon as he arrived, he'd start looking at his watch or the door, trying to figure out an escape route or a way to get out. But despite being allergic to the more traditional social events, Dad made deep and special connections with almost everyone he met. This was never more apparent than when we arrived at the Jewish General Hospital a little while ago for treatment. As he walked in, all the nurses on the floor lined up. They gathered around, and he would greet each one of them smiling. And he knew everyone's first name, asked after everyone, how they're doing, how's your son doing. He just had that kind of connection with everyone. And then when it was time to go after his treatment, the whole thing would happen in reverse, and everyone would line up again, and they would take a moment to pat him on the back and shake his hand, and he would give every single one of them a little moment, a little unique connection. So I know that Dad had that unique and special and deep connection with each and every one of you here today. And despite his obvious aversions to social functions, I know that he is here with us today, looking down and enjoying every moment of this event for him. I know without a shadow of a doubt that he appreciates so much you all being here. And Mom, Linz, and Dave, and I are touched and truly honored to have you here as well. For you to be here to support us, many people came thousands of miles from the West Coast or from Europe or braving the after effects of Hurricane Sandy in New York.
Kenya.
You honor us, we're deeply touched, and we would like to thank you for coming and being with us from the bottom of our hearts. Thank you.
I very proudly am a huge blubber, just like my dad. So if you can hear me while my voice goes up and down a few octaves, please bear with me. Thank you. Dad used to cry at Weight Watchers commercials. I'm not that easy. I'm crying for a very, very good reason. I remember turning around and going, Dad, what could you possibly be crying about? He's like, that's hilarious. Like, it's a Weight Watchers commercial. That's insane. I'm crying today because he was my Babaji. It may sound a little dramatic, but I'm very dramatic. And after he passed away, I thought, yeah, this must be how people must have felt after Gandhi died. He was my lighthouse. It's the image that keeps coming to me, and it feels like the lighthouse is a little bit farther away. Like, I can't see the actual building, but I can see and feel his light very, very strongly. And I'm very grateful, but I also feel that it will never leave me. Because Dad and I were like this since I was born. I was his favorite daughter. And I worked hard for that. He was... what made an amazing dad was cheering me on as I did interpretive dance to Chariots of Fire theme song or doing To Be or Not to Be with an Australian accent and a lisp. And he's there clapping along and my biggest supporter, and I feel like he's still my biggest supporter. And if I can do him justice, his enormous career and his huge legacy, it's two major things. His enthusiasm, and I've actually developed a little bit of a stutter, so maybe it's three things. That's okay, I don't mind. His stutter, okay, his enthusiasm. I'm currently in a relationship with hyperbole. That's totally fine. I get it directly from my father. But the last thing is feeling very, very, very grateful all the time. And whether it was him saying, look, 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 it's a cardinal. We're like, our ears work, you can say it once, but he was so enthusiastic all the time, every time we walked into a room. Arms open wide, big, huge smile. If he was on a conference call, I shouldn't admit this in front of a lot of his business colleagues, but he was on a conference call with 20 people raising gazillions of dollars, multiple millions of dollars, and he put everyone on mute to give me a kiss. So the enthusiasm and the gratitude was just unparalleled, and I really hope that the rest of my life can be a legacy to that. But the gratitude was very, very important. And I'm going to get you to join in with me on this practice. But he used to always make us as kids. He used to say, aren't we lucky? Because we have been so lucky. I feel like I won the family lottery. So, this is a hard act to follow. You are over there on these guys. But he used to say, aren't we? And then the rest of us used to have to say lucky. So, with mucho gusto. So if you would join me in my, not final, but big shout out to my dad. Oh, I'm gonna try to do this without sounding like a squirrel. Aren't we
lucky?
Thank you so much.
Thank you all so much for being here. It's very hard to follow the squirrel. My sister, your beautiful words, and especially to the incredible speakers that we had here tonight. I want to thank them, each one of them, for their efforts. It's an incredible memory for us. We're going to thankfully have this on video. When our feet land back on the ground, we'll be able to watch them and find out exactly what you said. But really, truly, from all of us, thank you so much for being here and for speaking today. And to everyone involved in the organization of the event, thank you. People have asked us how we're doing, and I remember asking friends who'd lost their parents, they ask us, how are you doing? And it's hard to imagine a life without my dad, and it's hard to put into words exactly what he meant to me and he meant to us. His children. But I want to just say a few words. My dad was a great, he used to say he was a great fan of brevity, and he never saw a film that was too short. And I thought that was pretty rich coming from a guy who made so many three-hour movies. But I'll try and keep this short. I don't think I'll ever get over his passing, but with the incredible support that we received from our friends and family, I've been moved to a place of profound love and gratitude. And when I'm asked, how are we doing, I have to say, it's because of you that we've been able to stay strong.
Okay, it's genetic.
It is genetic. Our family has really shown us, I would like to thank our immediate close family. They've really shown us the true meaning of love, and I'll be eternally grateful for them for taking us, holding us through this very, very challenging time. And I must also express my special appreciation to my girlfriend Maria. She's been she's been with me through thick and thin, through every last minute with my wonderful father. When I find myself struggling with deep feelings of loss, I'm quickly comforted by the incredible gifts that my father left behind. Not only the wonderful memories of times that we shared in the forest of his beloved Quebec, the jungles of Cambodia, the streets of Beijing, the deserts of Abu Dhabi, but the gift he gave us in the form of the life that he lived. And the example he set for us. His life inspired me to focus not on the tragedy of his untimely passing, but to embrace life with every ounce of my being. He was the ultimate role model, living his life with integrity, generosity, and the enthusiasm of a very young man, sometimes a small boy. He was never cynical, never jaded. He saw nothing but opportunity. But most of all, he sought joy and he sought adventure, and he did it with a pure heart. When I think of the people who loved Dad, who Dad loved most, so many of you are assembled here today. I'm struck by the indelible impression he made on so many lives, but you should know that he was equally inspired, encouraged, and encouraged by all of you. But there's one person who inspired him more than any other. I'm not talking about the inventor of the BlackBerry. His greatest inspiration was my mother, Fiona. She has been our rock and our light through a very difficult time. In my mom, my dad found his equal in generosity, in curiosity, and most of all, strength of character. So today, I'd like to toast my incredible father and at the same time raise a glass to the love of his life. As a son, I often think about the most lasting impression he gave me, and that would be to live life with an open heart, be good to people, and always do what you think is right. Two of Dad's closest friends, Jeff Skoll and Jim Burke, are here, and I'd like to play a wonderful interview they conducted with Dad a few years ago. It captures his spirit beautifully, and I want to just end by saying thank you for being here.
After having been an unsuccessful engineer, chemical engineer, an unsuccessful diesel engine salesman, a relatively unsuccessful investment banker, I kept on wondering when and where I was going to find my place in life, when I was going to wake up feeling that I was doing something useful. It occurred just one completely normal day. I was sitting in my office being an unsuccessful investment banker, and a friend of a friend walked in and asked me if I'd be interested in helping him make a movie. From that moment on, I just felt I discovered what I wanted to do in life. I was 35 years old at the time. That was 35 years ago. As I began to try and refine my interest in films and making films, and in particular in choosing subject matter, because there's only so much you can do, I simply allowed myself to feel, allowed intuition and my gut just tell me, is that something that I would be willing to devote an obsessive amount of time to over the next 2 or 3 or sometimes 10 years? When you meet all these people who have these enormous successes doing strange things, they all have a similar pattern. They all have this ability to really understand what they feel. When my kids say, how did you know that you wanted to get married to mother? You just know. It's not a question of balancing up the pros and the cons and adding up the columns and seeing, you know, do the pros outweigh the cons? You know. You have to follow what you know and what you feel and what you're obsessed by.
That's all we have.
Thank you so much to everyone. Thank you to the people who helped us organize this. We are deeply honored and touched, and we would love to join with you and discuss with you and continue the appreciation. Thank you so much for being here.
Wearing a high-heeled shoe and a low-neck sweater.